Lannan was conscious of the need to carry through the final ritual of the festival meticulously. It was apparent that he faced a national emergency of vast proportions, that Opit was opposed by an enemy more powerful and relentless than any in her long history. The oracle had spoken against him. Perhaps he or his kingdom had incurred the wrath of the gods. Lannan knew that the fate of nations hangs not entirely on the actions of men. Battles are not won by swords alone. He knew that there were influences beyond, sometimes malignant and sometimes benign, which dictated the outcome of earthly affairs. He knew it was possible to placate an angry god and to enlist the goodwill of one that was kindly disposed. As the Reverend Mother led him through the catechism beside the pool of Astarte, he paid special concern to the correctness of his responses. And there was no mistaking the sincerity of his voice as he made his pledge to the goddess. The priestesses closed in about him, and light hands helped him shed his robes of purple silk. Currents of cool air stroked his naked body as he strode forward to the edge of the pool, went down the stone steps, and lowered himself into the clear green waters. His body shone white below the surface, and his long golden tresses and beard glistened with water as the priestesses beside him scooped up water in the conch shells and poured it over his head. They emerged from the pool, and Lannan felt a sense of spiritual cleansing, as though the sacred waters had washed away his cares and armed him against the dangers that lay ahead. He was not a man of deep religious faith, and yet in this moment he felt uplifted. He was happy then that he had chosen such an important messenger for the goddess. His own petty and personal motives no longer counted. He was sending a priestess of the blood, a god-touched oracle, a person of value and weight. Surely the goddess must find her acceptable. Surely Astarte would now turn her countenance upon the children of Opet and spread her wings across the nation in this time of trial and danger. They dried off his skin, and the muscle was firm and beautifully shaped in leg and arm and wide shoulders. Two priestesses came forward and lifted a white silk robe over his head, the color of joy and rejoicing. The Reverend Mother placed a garland of flowers about his neck, crimson cave lilies, whose scent was sweet and heavy in the hushed cavern. It was the moment when the praise of the goddess must be sung, and then the offertory. The silence persisted a moment longer, and then a voice rang through the cavern. The voice startled Lannan, and he turned his head, searching for the singer. There was no mistaking that voice, the sweet, shimmering power of it, the depth and timbre that made the hair on Lannan's forearms come erect and set the echoes flying about the temple, seeming almost to ruffle the quiet surface of the green pool. Lannan gaped at Hui. He had stepped out of the ranks of nobles and officers, and as he sang, he paced slowly towards Lannan. His arms spread in the sun sign, his mouth wide open, showing the strong white teeth, and that achingly beautiful voice pouring from his throat. The praise song ended, and Hui stood close beside the king, looking up at him. His face was still raddled with fatigue, the dark eyes still underscored by bluish-purple smears, the skin pale and drawn. But he was smiling at Lannan with an expression of loyal affection.
"Hui," Lannan whispered in horror, "why are you here? I left you resting, with orders not to disturb you."
"At this time my place was with you."
You shouldn't have come," Lannan protested.
This was beyond his planning. It was not part of it that Hui should witness the death of the witch. He had not intended torturing him with the deed. Wildly, Lannan considered halting the ritual, withdrawing the sacrifice, ordering Hui to leave the temple. Yet Lannan realized that the safety of the empire might be resolved in these next few moments. Could he halt the sacrifice? Dare he risk antagonizing the goddess? Was his duty to Hui greater than his duty to Opet? Was it not already too late? Had he not committed himself long ago to this path? Were the gods and demons mocking him now? Could he not hear their hellish laughter echoing in the deserts of his soul? Bewildered and appalled, he stared at Hui, took a step towards him, reaching out one hand in entreaty, as though asking for understanding and forgiveness.
I need you, he said hoarsely.
And Hui, not understanding, took the hand, thinking it the hand of friendship. Proudly, he smiled at his king and friend as he began to sing the offertory to the goddess. His voice rose on eagle's wings, flying up to the sacrificial platform in the roof of the cavern high above them. All the eyes in the temple turned upwards also, and a tense, expectant hush gripped the throng of worshippers. Tanith could not believe it was happening to her. When they'd come to her cell in the dawn, she thought it must be Hui come to fetch her away. She had leapt from her couch and run to meet him. It was not Hui, but Sister Haka. They had taken her from the temple up the secret steps to the top of the cliffs above Opet. There, in a stone building with a roof of thatch beside the sacrificial platform over the gaping hole above the pool of Astarte, they had dressed her in the rich embroidered robes of the sacrifice and put flowers in her hair. Then they had draped her with the heavy gold chains and bracelets and leg bangles until Tanith felt she must collapse beneath the weight of them. She knew that this treasure formed part of the sacrifice, that it was also intended to weigh her down swiftly into the green depth of the pool. The pool which had no bottom to it. The pool which would carry her to the bosom of the goddess. Solemnly and in silence, she was seated at the small banquet table, and her sister priestesses waited upon her, pressing her with choice foods and wines. It was the feast of farewell, the feast to someone who goes upon a journey. Tanith sipped a little of the wine, hoping that it might warm her icy spirit. Hui, she thought, where are you, my love? At last, a priestess came to the door and nodded to the others. There were 15 of them, all strong young women, more than enough of them to overwhelm any resistance. They closed in about where Tanith sat, not yet menacing, but utterly determined. They looked down on her expressionlessly, their faces closed against pity or regret. Come, said one of them, and Tanith stood up. They led her through the doorway into the sunlight, and ahead of her she saw the curved stone platform jutting out over the dark and gaping hole in the earth. The path to the sacrificial platform was strewn with blossoms of the yellow mimosa tree, a flower sacred to the goddess. The scent was light and nostalgic on the warm, still air, and the blossoms crushed beneath Tanith's bare feet as she passed over them, weighted down by her chains of gold and the heaviness of her dread. Suddenly she stopped, frozen at the sound of the voice issuing from the pit before her. A voice, faint with distance and echoing strangely from the cavern walls, but the voice of such purity and beauty that she could not help but recognize it. Hui, she whispered, my lord. But the upwards flight of her spirits was short-lived, for the voice of Hui Ben Ammon was uplifted in the offertory of the sacrifice. It was Hui who was sending her to the goddess. And in that moment, a vision of hell and desolation opened before her. she found herself caught in the web of some monstrous conspiracy, not understanding it clearly, knowing only that Hui had deserted her. He was against her also. He was the one offering her to the goddess. There was nothing to live for now. It was easy to take those last few steps up onto the platform. As she paused on the brink, she spread her arms in the sun sign and looked down into the gloom of the cavern. The waters of the pool were still and dark, and beside them stood the king and the priest. They were looking up at her, but it was too far for her to judge their expressions. All she knew was that Hui's voice was still raised in prayer, offering her to the goddess. She felt hatred and anger replacing desolation, and she did not want to die with those emotions in her heart. To forestall them, she swayed forward over the drop, over the deep green pool, and as she felt her balance go, Hui's voice stopped abruptly, cut off in the middle of a word. Slowly, she leaned out over the drop, and then suddenly she was in the air, plunging downwards, hurtling towards the pool by the weight of gold she carried. As her stomach swooped within her, she heard Hui's voice again, raised in a shriek of despair, as he called her name. Tanith! She struck the surface of the pool with such force that all life was crushed from her, and the heavy ornaments plucked her beneath the limpid waters so swiftly that Hui only saw the brief gleam of gold deep down, as though a great fish had turned upon its side to feed. Manatasi crossed the great river in the winter of the opiate year 543. He used the cooler weather to carry his armies through the valley where the water was at its lowest levels. He crossed with three armies of varying size. The smallest, a mere 70,000 warriors, crossed in the west and overwhelmed the garrisons there. They drove swiftly for the western shores of the Lake of Opet, where the narrow waterway drained the lake and gave access to the ocean for the galleys of Opet. It was called the River of Life, the artery that fed the heart of Opet. Manatasi's impis severed the artery, freed the slaves employed at dredging the channel, and slaughtered the garrison and slave masters. Most of Habakkuk Lal's fleet was drawn up on the beach, careened for cleansing of the hulls. The galleys were burned where they lay, and the sailors thrown alive on the fires. Then Manatasi's war captain blocked the channel. His warriors and the tens of thousands of freed slaves tore down a small granite hill which stood beside the River of Life and dumped it into the narrowest stretch of the river, rendering it impassable to any vessel larger than a canoe. This was a labor comparable with the construction of the Great Pyramid of Cheops, and it effectively sealed off the city and the population of Opet from the outside world. At the same time, a second, larger army crossed in the east, swept unhindered through the territory of the Draves, and burst like a black storm on the hills of Zeng. The third and largest army, nearly 750,000 strong, surged across the river at Set. Manatasi commanded them in person, and he chose the crossing place as a gesture. Marmon hurried to oppose him with his single legion of 6,000 men and was crushed in a swift and bloody battle. Marmon fled the field and died on his own sword amidst the burning ruins of Zanat. Manatasi placed his center across the road to Opet and rolled along it. His front was 3 miles wide and 20 deep, a multitude whose own bulk reduced the march to a stately progress. Manatasi swept the land. He took no prisoner, neither man nor woman nor child. He took no loot, burning cloth and book and leather, smashing pot and cup, throwing it all upon the funeral pyre of a nation. The buildings he burnt, and then threw down, and scattered the hot stone slabs. As his hatred fed upon this destruction, so it seemed to grow. Like the very flames he lit, it burnt higher, the more was heaped upon it. The total fighting strength of Opet was 9 legions. Of these, 1 had died with Marmon in the north, and 2 others were hacked to pieces upon the terraces of Zeng, the survivors holding out in 12 besieged fortresses upon the crest of the hills. With the remaining 6 legions, Lannan Hyrcanus marched from Opet to meet Manatasi. They came together 150 miles northeast of Opet, and Lannan won a victory which gained him 2 miles of territory and 1 day's respite, but which cost him 4,000 dead and wounded. Backmore, who commanded Legion Ben-Ammon in the absence of the high priest, came to Lannan's tent upon the battlefield when the sky still glowed like a furnace from the cremation fires, and the stench of scorching flesh spoilt what little appetite for food battle fatigue had left. "The enemy left 48,000 dead upon the field," Backmore reported exultantly, and Lannan saw he was a young man no longer. How the years had sped away. "We took 12 for each of ours," Backmore went on. Lannan looked up at him, sitting on his couch while a physician dressed a minor wound in his arm, and he saw that dried sweat and blood had stiffened Backmore's hair and beard, and that there were new lines and shadows in the handsome face. "How soon can you fight again?" Lannan asked, and the shadows around Backmore's eyes deepened. "It was a hard day," he said. Legion Ben-Ammon had held the center firm during those desperate hours when it seemed the line must sunder at the pressure of black bodies and darting steel. "How soon?" Lannan repeated. "In 4 or 5 days," Backmore told him. "My men are weary." "It will be sooner than that," Lannan warned him. They fought again the following day, a battle as desperate and as costly as the other. Again Lannan won a heavy victory, but he could not hold the field, and he must leave over 1,000 of his wounded to the hyena and jackal, while he fell back to a new defensive line of hills. They fought again 5 days later, and 5 times more in the next 70 days. At the end of that time, they were encamped 20 Roman miles from Opet, and Lannan's 6 fine legions had shrunk to 3. It mattered not that they'd won 8 great battles, and that they'd slain almost 200,000 of the enemy, for Zeng had fallen, only a handful of warriors winning through to describe its fate. The towns were burnt and razed to the ground, the gardens cut down and burnt also. The mines of the Middle Kingdom were destroyed, the slaves freed to join Manatasi's horde, and the shafts blocked with earth and rock. The channel of the River of Life was choked with rock. There was no escape upon Habakkuk Lal's galleys now, and from east and west, new armies marched to reinforce Manatasi's drive on Opet.